Stonesy kind of weekend in Chicago. Swanee in the newsroom dancing like Mick Jagger right now.
Not quite.
Swanee, you've got moves like Jagger.
Not quite. Not as agile as he was. I saw the video.
How about that?
Friday's concert. He is amazing.
Heart valve replacement surgery 2 months ago, and he's dancing like crazy on stage. God bless him. Fun, fun, fun.
You bet.
Kind of wish I was in Burlington, Iowa right
now. Why?
I don't know. Sounds peaceful. Joe, are you still there?
Yeah, it's a gloomy, beautiful day in Burlington, Iowa. It's fine.
Well, the weather's gloomy, but I'm sure Burlington's very picturesque.
You know what? This is actually one of my favorite places to go when we travel around the Midwest. This is one of the better spots.
Yeah, that's what I think. Like, what did you do in your spare time? What do you do there?
Well, you know, luckily, our hotel is attached to a casino.
Oh.
And there's actually, like, one of the biggest problems we have in the minor leagues is trying to find food after the ball game.
Right.
Luckily, there's a late-night bar that serves pizza until midnight.
Oh, very nice.
So we luck out here.
That's not bad.
It's
be at a casino that serves pizza?
Yes. Two separate entities,
that's
but
good
yeah,
living.
Sure.
That's good living, if you ask me.
You can walk to the ballpark. It's nice. It's peaceful is a good word.
I like places like Burlington, Iowa. I've never been to Burlington, but I've been to many cities like that you're describing. And I enjoy the, I guess you would say, small town ambiance, although, I mean, it's not like Burlington is Mayberry or, you know, something like that. But smaller than Chicago, I mean.
It is the smallest town to host a minor league baseball team.
Oh, really?
Yep.
What is the hometown team in Burlington?
The Burlington Bees, the Class A affiliate of the Los Angeles Angels.
Are they any good?
You know what? Cougars just took them for 3 games.
Well, I'm going to say no then.
A couple three good games, though. They're okay.
Swanee, you visited many small towns in your travels. What do you have a favorite place? Like, if you could be in a place like Joe this morning, you know, small,
where would I be?
Small town, charming, and as in Joe's words, dreary.
Gloomy,
right.
Well, that's a good question.
I know where I'd be. I would be in Escanaba, Michigan.
You know what? Yeah, Michigan would be my choice also. I would, this morning, I think I would pick a place like Traverse City, Michigan.
Okay.
Ludington.
Ludington's nice.
Mackinac Island, which is magical.
Yeah.
I think that would fill the bill for me.
Yeah, those would be nice. As a kid, we used to go up near Escanaba in the Upper Peninsula of Michigan. Escanaba, Gladstone, Rapid River. We used to go up there camping.
Yeah. That's perfect camping.
It's just very, Escanaba's the big city among in that area. And there's an A&W root beer, and you go and get a nice creamy root beer, and you stroll. I forget what the name of the main street is. You stroll the main street.
It's Main Street.
Say, might be. It very well might be.
It's Main Street.
It's possible. Say hello to everybody. Say hi to Floyd the barber, who's you know, out in front of his shop.
Wayne the bartender.
Wayne the bartender talking to Harry Carey.
Gomer yelling citizens arrest.
Yeah, all that. It's a lovely. It's a very charming way of life.
Yeah, and it is much slower. I you know, having driven around places in old Michigan, central southern Indiana, if you're stopped at a stoplight and the light turns green and you don't go right away, the person behind you doesn't honk their horn.
Yeah.
they say, oh!
Unless I'm the person behind you.
Unless you are behind me. And you do much more than just honk the horn.
Somebody from out of town's here. That's how you can tell who's from out of town. Because they act like a jerk.
It is so true, though. Total strangers, you pass by, they'll say good morning to you.
Go to the diner.
Strike up a conversation.
Yeah.
Yep.
That's good living there, Joe.
What's wrong with those people?
You're living the good life there, Joe.
That's funny. I worked for a minor league team in Traverse City, too. I learned a lot in my 3 months
I love
there.
Traverse City.
I learned the
beautiful
whole hand map thing that they do.
When you're asking directions and they draw it on their hand?
With the mitt?
Where are you from? And they just stick up their hand and point to your
index
finger.
Right. Yeah. I'm here.
Oh, that makes sense.
Oh, okay.
That makes sense. I'm gonna, in fact, after the show today, I'm gonna go out onto Michigan Avenue and, you know, do that. Look for people looking for directions, and when they do, I'm gonna stick my hand up in the air, and point to different fingers and see if it's taken the same way.
I'm gonna see how long it takes for you to get arrested when you do that. Then.
Yeah. All right. Well, Joe, we'll talk to you again throughout the show. Go enjoy. You probably time for you to go get some more pizza in the casino.
Yeah, I'll if you don't hear from me, I'm playing blackjack.
All right, that means he's winning. Whenever you hear Joe on the show this morning, that means he is not doing well at the craps table. It's 9:21 this morning. You must have heard where you live, Schwani, the Stones on Friday night. Were you home Friday night?
No, I was not home Friday night.
At all? Where were you?
I was out and around in other parts of the city.
Got any pictures to show us?
No, not offhand. But the trademark logo now for the Stones
the tongue
was on the sidewalks.
Yeah, it's everywhere.
At State and Roosevelt and elsewhere. But I saw the crowd starting to build on Friday, you know, headed over east Soldier Field.
Oh, yeah.
The Soldiers Field. They were at the Soldiers Field.
Yeah, I'm going to see the Mick Jagger's and...
And before they went there, they stopped at the Jewels.
I want to go see the Keith Dean Richards guy to see him play over at the Soldiers Field.
The Stones.
I saw them at the stadium. People have been emailing me and texting me, telling me their Rolling Stones stories for the last few days of where they've seen them and, you know, what kind of experience it was. Apparently, they played the stadium a couple of times.
The old Chicago Stadium?
Yeah. I mean, the big names, if they've been around for a while, that's where you played. That was the big venue in town.
That's true.
For the longest time.
Before the Soldiers Field.
The Soldiers. Well, they played the Soldiers Field back then. I believe they played, I want to say, well, I'm not sure if they played.
Every time they've been in town for the last, 20 years, they've played at the Soldiers Field.
Yeah, they're pretty popular. You know, there is a photographic exhibit of the Rolling Stones that's at the original Chess Records location on South Michigan Avenue, 2120 South Michigan Avenue. Chess Records that famously recorded Muddy Waters, Willie Dixon, Etta James, Chuck Berry, and Mick Jagger and Keith Richards back in when they were first starting were so enamored with Chicago-style blues that when they came to perform here at McCormick Place,
Oh, the original McCormick Place.
1964.
Yeah.
They made a stop over at Chess Records on South Michigan Avenue, and they did a recording session there. And that recording session is the subject of this photographic exhibit that's at the Chess Records location, which you can go and, you know, check out these really cool photographs that are there.
And I would think that would have been the recording session, seriously, where they came up with the song 2120 South Michigan That's Avenue.
Exactly correct, my friend. Yep. So they were paying tribute to this mecca of blues that they consider, because it was Mick and Keith so into Chicago blues style, especially, but Muddy Waters especially. You know, their name, the Rolling Stones, came from a Muddy Waters song. That's how they decided to name themselves that.
That's right.
So they were totally into it. So for them to be in the very studio, which the studio still exists there, they've, you know, it's set up like a museum exhibit now, but you can actually go into the same studio where all of these blues greats once were and where the Rolling Stones recorded in 1964. It was June, I want to say 20... Well, I'm not sure of the date. It was June 1964 that they did that recording session, 55 years ago. It's music history. And
it sure is. You know, I also think they went down to the Checkerboard Lounge on the south side.
Several times.
Yeah,
several times. They loved Chicago blues, and they loved all the Chicago blues players, Buddy Guy. You know, you name
every
the
one
Chicago
of them.
Blues great.
Yeah.
The Stones... worship them. Eric Clapton, same thing, played there and, you know, worship them. Very same thing. That's where I got together with, on Friday morning, Daryl Jones, who is the bass player for the Rolling Stones since 1993. He's from the south side of Chicago, went to CVS, Chicago Vocational High School, where I went. I was a few years ahead of him. But, you know, he's been with the Rolling Stones since 1993, and we did some TV segments there the other day. And he's going to join us live on the program this morning to talk about that, but just talk about what it's like to be on tour with the Rolling Stones. Daryl's a great guy. Not a lot of people can give us that special behind-the-scenes insight.
That's right, and this is why this show offers things that no other program in the history of broadcasting offers.
This show, that you mean?
This very program.
This one that's on the air right now?
Right on WGN.
Wow.
That's right.
I should listen some week. I am going to start paying more
attention. I wondered what you've done in that other room over there for 4 hours on Sunday.
I am definitely going to start paying more attention. That sounds like a very interesting show. In addition, Tom Holland, who is the new Spider-Man in the Marvel Comics series. I ran over to London this week for a few days, and we interviewed the whole cast of this new Spider-Man movie, Far From Home. He'll be on the show today. You know who's going to be on today? Talk about WGN veterans, longtime veterans and familiar voices. You know the voice of Jim Fizell, who's was on Orion Samuelson's midday show, the farm show, for years, giving horticultural advice. He's going to join us later in the show today. It's prime growing season right now. So he's going to tell you how to make your gardens a little better and your fruits and vegetables that you may be growing a little better. So we've got a lot of good stuff here today. I am actually going to pay attention. Chwani, that's very good advice. Thank you for that.
Yes, indeed.
That and so much more all coming up this morning. Here it's Dean Richards Sunday morning. Later in the show, one-on-one with the new Spider-Man, young Tom Holland. Takes over the role. I was in London this past week, talked with him and the cast of the new Spider-Man Far From Home. Share that with you this morning. And we'll show it to you all this week on the WGN-TV Morning News, where you see Larry Potash, Robin Baumgarten, Paul Conrad, Pat Tomasulo, and company. Sunday nights at 8:30, Larry's new show, Backstory, digs into some really interesting stories. Larry's on the line with us right now. Good morning to you, Larry.
Good morning, Dean.
What's up on the old Backstory this week?
Well, we have a story of a guy who discovered a photograph of his father. And it was really kind of a professional photograph, which he thought was odd since his dad was poor growing up in Eastern Europe. And he went down to track down the story overseas and discovered his father not only escaped one death march during the Holocaust, but two. And most people don't get to escape the Nazis and live to tell about it, but he did. And it was an amazing journey with a lot of surprises. And so we did that story, and we did doing a story about this little town south of Colorado where Supermax is located. That's the prison that holds the most notorious prisoners like the Unabomber. Yeah. And this town has 11 prisons, and it's kind of a sleepy little town. And this one man single-handedly is buying up all the historic buildings and restoring them and trying to turn them into a tourist attraction. But one of the buildings, a big hotel, used to be the headquarters for the Klan. And we found some really creepy pictures of the Klan. There are some secret tunnels under the hotel. So it's a really cool story with a dark past, and they're trying to turn around into something fun.
when you go to the Palmer House or the Hilton Hotel or any of the Drake, the famous hotels, often in the hallways, they have pictures of their glorious past. Please don't tell me that this hotel has photographs like that celebrating its history throughout the hotel.
Well, it might, but it wouldn't be about the Klan. It does have a glorious past. It used to be the silent film center of the country.
Really?
And the company in Chicago was making the silent films there.
Yeah.
And so all the stars used to stay in this hotel. This was before the Klan, of course. And the silent film went bust there because one of the actresses fell off a horse into the river, and a stagehand or something went in to save her. They both end up dying, and the production company shut down. And so it wasn't until many years later that John Wayne came in. I think it was True Grit, and some other Westerns were all filmed there. So while people may not know this watching TV or the old movies, a lot of those Westerns were filmed in this town. And so they would all stay at this hotel, and eventually the Klan moved in.
Wow. How about that? What a bizarre history. The story of the guy who found this mysterious photo of his dad, did he know that his dad had been in even one death march or had this history? A lot of people, when they come back from any war, they don't want to talk about it. So often families don't even know, you know, these very difficult to talk about experiences that their loved ones had gone through.
Right. His dad did talk about it, and this is a big part of the story. He talked about it, but he talked about it in a very different way than was factual. He would say, "Oh, you know, we went out for a walk. Oh, you know, we just, wow. you know, we got some exercise," or, you know, he'll say, "You know, I had a job." And so he, yeah. you know, realized just how horrendous this was. One of the ways he escaped was kind of interesting. They're on this 34-mile death march, and they come into an intersection, and there are some refugees coming the other way. And this is like something out of a Mel Brooks movie. He's walking, and he sees the refugees, and he just takes a right-hand turn, and he blends in with the refugees,
wow.
and nobody saw him, and boom, he's gone.
Wow.
So it sounds like, come on, give me a break. That can't be true. It's a true story, but that's only one of the two escapes. We'll tell you how this all kind of played out.
All right. Well,
I'm sorry, go ahead, Dave.
No, I can't wait to see both of those stories, but also I love some of the footage that you find on the backstory show. And tonight you're going to take us to spring training for the White Sox in 1983?
Yes. We found this piece. I want to say the sportscaster is, I think it's Bill Frink or something, you know.
Frankie. Yeah, Bill Frank. He was a WGN. He was part of the Happy Talk group over at Channel 7 back in the day with Fahey Flynn and Joel Daly.
Boy Calder? Daly, yeah.
Yeah, and John Coleman was the wacky weatherman. Mm-hmm. Bill Frank was their sports guy. And then he came over to Channel 9.
So in this video, they said, "We're going to introduce you to this new form of exercise in spring training." And that new form of exercise was aerobics. And so there's this woman out there dressed like Olivia Newton-John in physical.
Fantastic.
And all these baseball players are sitting there doing leg kicks. <You know? laughs> And, of course, Frank is making comments, you know, that you wouldn't necessarily make today on TV
about the ladies.
So, you know, nothing that crazy, but you know, you just we look at that stuff a whole different way today.
Yeah, right. Bill Veeck was still alive then, right? And owner of the team.
In the early 80s, I'm not sure.
This has got Bill Veeck written all over it, like the kind of wacky stuff that Bill Veeck would do.
I think Tony La Russa was behind this, but I'm not 100% sure, because, you know, sometimes we go in that library in the archive and there's no information whatsoever.
Yeah.
There's no index card. There's no script. It's just like, oh, here's a video.
Yeah, cataloging and record keeping was not a big priority back in the old days.
Right. Of WGN. Right.
Can't wait to see all of it. It's on Larry's Backstory Show tonight at 8:30 on WGN TV. Larry. Friday night at Soldier Field. The joint was rocking. Rolling Stones kicking off their No Filter tour. Anybody thought that Mick Jagger was going to be slowed down at all by a little heart valve surgery? They were shown just how wrong they are. As he and Keith, Ronnie, and Charlie Watts, and our pal, Daryl Jones, rocked a sold-out crowd Friday night at Soldier Field. Daryl joins us on the phone right now. Daryl, good morning. Thank you so much for joining us again.
Good morning, Dane. How are you this morning?
I'm doing great. Look how chill you sound. Like you just didn't do a sold-out show at Soldier Field.
Yeah, well, you caught me. You know, it's early for me this morning. Yeah. So, you know.
So what was? I was looking at footage from the show, and you were front and center with the guys. You know, Mick comes out on stage, the place goes wild. What is that? How can you describe that feeling of what it's like to kick off a tour, number one, but in your hometown with Mick Jagger, who's just back from heart surgery? As you told me on Friday morning, you would never even know that Mick had anything done. But what was the feeling like? The adrenaline must have been through the roof.
No, it was great, man. It's a real pleasure, you know, being home in Chicago and playing. You know, as I mentioned to you before, Soldier Field is a real special, you know, venue for me, and being home in Chicago and that, you know, everybody in the band is fine. It was great. It was really, really a wonderful moment, you know, to come out and feel that kind of response.
Is it kind of routine? Because, I mean, you've been with the band, you've been one of the Rolling Stones since 1993. It's a long time. You've done countless shows, countless albums. You know, is everybody okay? Let's go out and do another one.
Yeah, no, I mean, that's the joy of music, you know, that you can go out and, you know, play some of the same stuff and do it a little bit differently every night and keep it exciting. And, this is a band that, you know, seems to know how to stay around and do just that. So,
Yeah, there is a certain, just watching it, it looked like, you know, so comfortable for everybody, you know, like old pros who knew how to go out and have fun and entertain the crowd for 2 hours.
Yeah, no, we had a great time. It was a very nice starting night for a tour.
Yeah. Now, do you have a, you know, like one plan when you go on stage if the weather's nice, and another plan if it rains? I mean, are there plan B and C, like, you know, that sort of thing?
You know, it's funny because for the first time I heard some talk about that. You know, I don't remember exactly what it was, but I did hear some talk about that if it rained, it, you know, the set list might change. Yeah.
But it didn't rain. It turned out to be a beautiful night. So
beautiful night, really lovely. We got lucky. Yeah. Between the raindrops on that.
Do you have favorite moments in a show? I mean, not on Friday night, were there certain songs or certain moments that were just electric to you?
Well, you know, there are always, you know, one or two moments that, you know, that really, you know, catch your attention on the show, or generally there are. Midnight Rambler is always, a kind of special moment for me because it's a little bit more unscripted. You know, we kind of just get out there and play, and that's always, you know, always something that, you know, interesting happens that, you know, that seems to be a little bit of a spark for the evening.
Yeah. Yeah. Interesting watching the show, and I liked some of the Chicago-ness that Mick brought to the show, where he gave a big shout out to our new mayor, Lori Lightfoot. But yeah. He said he wanted to welcome Lori Lightfoot, and he was sorry that Ed Burke couldn't make it.
Yeah.
So doing a little political satire as well, which was very funny.
Yeah, you know, he tries to keep it light, and you know, and also comment on what's going on in the city. Yeah, he's good at that. He's really great at that.
He mentioned that he's never had an Italian beef sandwich. Daryl, how have you how have you never gotten him an Italian beef sandwich?
No, that is definitely one of those Chicago favorites, you know. But I guess we all have our Chicago favorites, you know.
Right. Well, here's the word. Mick said on Friday that he's never had an Italian beef sandwich. If, you know, some of the Italian beef joints around town, if they're listening to this,
want to
bombard Soldier Field with Italian beef sandwiches for Tuesday. And also gave you a big shout out on stage of being, you know, back in your hometown and all that. That had to make you feel good, I would think.
Yeah, it's been really great being home, man. I'm slightly partial to this city. You know, I really am.
You sure are. And it goes back to you. We've talked about this so many times on TV and elsewhere. We had a great morning Friday morning over at Chess Records. Daryl was nice enough to come and join us at this historic spot where Mick and Keith and the Stones at the time recorded because of their worshiping that hallowed ground where Muddy Waters and Willie Dixon and Chuck Berry and so many, Etta James and so many of the greats recorded. They also wanted to record there, which they did 55 years ago. And Daryl was nice enough to come over and do some segments with us on television for that. Talk a little bit how you went from a kid on the South Side, now being part of the Rolling Stones. It's an amazing journey.
Yeah, well, you know, I grew up in a musical household. My parents always listened to a lot of music. My dad was a drummer. He taught me to read music when I was pretty young. Saw a friend in a talent show. It really impressed me, and I decided that I wanted to try music. Got into the school system, and there was a great school at Chicago Vocational High School with a great instructor, Dr. Miller. I grew up in the Chicago music scene where the elders on the scene taught the younger guys, so I prepared me for what was to happen, and I got a real lucky break and, got my first gig with Miles Davis. So it was really pretty, my development has been pretty charmed, and is also very rootly, deeply rooted in the music scene and the music styles of Chicago. And they seem to be, work very universally for me. And so, yeah, I had a good education coming from here, and it's a great, music town. And I think that's, large part why I've been as successful as I have.
So how do you go from, you played with some of the jazz and blues greats prior to joining the Rolling Stones, but how do you go from working those gigs to getting the attention of Mick and Keith and, the people with the Stones, to having them go, "Hey, mate, we'd like you to join us. Come and join us and be part of the band."
Well, in the music business, you kind of tend to meet people. I guess I met Mick when I, did an earlier gig with Sting. And I met Keith through the guys that played in his his band, Keith's band, Expensive Winos. And they just kind of familiarized me with some of that music and some of that scene, and they introduced me to him. And just by kind of hook or crook, I heard about an audition, and things kind of went from there. I went and played, and I guess the rest is history, as I said.
Yeah. What have been some of the highlights for you to have been part of, this, what has been called the world's greatest rock and roll band? Have there been some moments along the way, places where you've gone, things that you've seen that, you have to pinch yourself that you're being a part of?
Oh, yeah. Well, a number of years ago, we ended up recording in Japan. And there was a case in which B.B. King was brought in, and I got a chance to record with B.B. King because the Stones were doing a tune with him for one of his records, and so that's definitely a standout. We played in front of a pretty big crowd in Brazil back in 2005, 2006, I think. More than a million people. That was something that really kind of sticks out. Argentina is a kind of Grand Central for Stones fans, and so playing down there is always very exciting. There's really exciting crowds down there and all over South America, and it's like Bobby Keys said, every night's a Saturday night with the Stones.
Yeah, I can imagine.
There have been many, many great nights, like that.
I can imagine. Let me take a quick break. We'll come right back and talk for a couple of more minutes with Daryl Jones, bass player with the Rolling Stones since 1993, Chicago's very own. We'll be right back after this. Tony Bennett, Hugh Jackman. I understand putting on a great show at the United Center on Friday night. But the Stones with another show on Tuesday night at Soldier Field. Daryl Jones, bass player with the group, 1993, Chicago's very own, on the line with us this morning. Daryl, how do you describe what it was like when you guys got the news that Mick was going to have heart surgery? There must have been a real moment of pause for everybody involved in the organization, I would think.
Yeah, yeah, it was definitely a bit of a shock. You know, he's from what everybody can see, it's, you know, pretty obvious he's in, you know, great shape, and it's just the kind of thing that you didn't really expect to hear from him. But I was pretty confident that he would come through it well, because he, you know, takes very good care of himself.
And, boy, if you saw the footage of the show, or if you were at the concert itself Friday night, he did not miss a beat. He sounded great. He looked great. His moves were amazing, as always. And I'm pretty sure that is it going to be the same show this coming Tuesday night, basically, that you do? I'm sure a few things might be a little different, but is it basically the same set list?
There'll be a few changes. You know, they like to mix things up a little bit, particularly if we play in the same city. So, yeah, there'll be a few changes.
Now, what do you do in your days off here? You played Friday night, which means you had last night, tonight, Monday night you'll have off. What do you do? I mean, this is your hometown. Maybe do you visit with old friends and family and like
that? Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, I've got family here, so, you know, I'm with them as much as I can be, because living in Los Angeles, I don't see them as much as I should, you know.
Right.
So I spend a lot of my time here with, you know, with family and a few friends, you know.
And what do you think what are the guys doing on their days off?
I have no idea. That's, you know, it's one of those things where, you know, end of the show, everybody just kind of disperses and, you know.
They all go their separate ways?
Yeah, generally everybody goes their separate ways. We might get together for dinner, you know, from time to time. But, everybody kind of does their own thing.
Because I would think that, I mean, they can't be too much out in public. They would get mobbed. But also, I'm guessing, you know, they also don't want to be sequestered in their hotel rooms either, I would think.
Yeah, no, everybody moves around, you know, pretty much, you know, when they want to and how they want to. There's, you know, there's enough of an infrastructure around them that they, you know.
That they're protected for if they want to go and do, see and do things, I guess.
Yeah.
So I'm picturing Mick and Keith in line to get some Garrett's popcorn, you know, something like that. Museum of Science and Industry.
that's kind of unlikely, I guess. Yeah.
Are there rehearsals when you have this many days off also before the next show?
The sound check kind of functions as, you know, a time where, you know, where we kind of work things out. So yeah. No, on off day, it's generally wouldn't be any kind of rehearsal.
So that'll be Tuesday then. Before the show that night, you'll do a sound check, and that's kind of your rehearsal.
Exactly.
That's fascinating. Daryl, it's been so great to see you while you've been back in town. I can't thank you enough for...
Man, it's really my pleasure, Dean. And, you know, you've been so so helpful, man, when I'm in town doing anything. I appreciate you guys. I really appreciate WGN for, you know, helping support, you know, my projects here in town and being so cool, man. Thank you. Thank you very much.
We think the world of you, and keep rocking and rolling. We can't wait to hear more. Daryl, have a great time while you're here at home. That's Daryl Jones, bass player with the Rolling Stones. Thank you, my friend. We'll see you soon. We do our best to try to cover as many aspects of what's going on in theater in Chicago as possible. And usually, you know, they're musicals and they're fun and frolicky. Kind of a feel to them, but occasionally we like to focus in on some of the more serious subject matter that is going to be presented on stage as well. And coming to the North Shore Center for Performing Arts in Skokie next week, Wednesday, June 26th through Sunday, June 30th, is a production that is called Wiesenthal, a play about Nazi hunter Simon Wiesenthal. Playwright, director Tom Dugan joins us on the phone to talk about this a little bit. Tom, thank you for joining us. Good morning.
Thanks for having me.
So tell us, you know, first of all, you know, in terms of subject matter, how it is that you chose to put together something. You've done several one-person shows, and from my understanding, you saw an obituary when Simon Wiesenthal passed away, and that's what sparked the idea for you.
Yeah, I guess I had the inkling to do a story of this type because my father, he would hate to hear me say this, but he was a war hero. He received the Bronze Battle Star and the Purple Heart. He liberated a camp called Langenstein when he was about 19 years old, and I grew up with the stories of what it was like for him as a young man to see such things and to experience such horror and to see mankind at its worst.
Yeah.
And he tried his best to pass on to me things that he had learned about tolerance. And I always put it in the back of my mind, even at that young age, that I wanted to somehow, well, certainly carry on that teaching in any way I could. I didn't know what I was going to do. So later on, I became a playwright. And when I read Wiesenthal's obituary, and specifically when they talked about his rejection of collective guilt, that really piqued my interest. And so I decided to start researching, and then I wrote a play, and now I've been touring with it for 12 years, I guess, now.
Yeah, it's been on Broadway. Has it been in Chicago before? For some reason, in my mind, I think that it did play here once before.
We came to Skokie, to the North Shore Performing Arts Center, last year, and for just a few performances, and it was such a success that they had us come on back to do a full week of performances. And the performances are at the North Shore Performing Arts Center. So I'm just going to put my plug in there any chance I can.
Yeah, of course. And we'll mention how people can get tickets for the shows that are coming up this coming Wednesday through next Sunday, the 30th. Talk to me and explain to our audience, who was Simon Wiesenthal?
Simon Wiesenthal was a Holocaust survivor, and he spent the rest of his life hunting down, through the legal process, former Nazis who were war criminals. Many of these men just changed their names and went off to Central America, South America, and had fine lives. Some even went to the United States. And the legal system wasn't in any hurry to go find them, because all the governments were interested in now the Soviet problem, the Cold War, and they had that on their minds, not going and seeking justice for all the millions who were killed. Simon Wiesenthal held these individual governments, the Germany, the United States, Poland, Austria, he held their government's feet to the fire to make sure they lived up to what the laws said they were supposed to do, which was to prosecute these mass murderers.
Now, when you tell Wiesenthal's story, are you starting from that period following the Holocaust? Are you starting before that so we learn who he was as a young man?
The story is part memoir, part spy thriller. And what the audience becomes in this play is the last group of students who comes to Simon Wiesenthal's Jewish Documentation Center in Vienna on the day of his retirement. And so the audience, you know, gets to become that last group, because he did see many, many groups of students. And he tells the story of basically what he says is Simon Wiesenthal's greatest hits. But during that time, he's also on the phone, and the audience gets to listen as Wiesenthal is closing in on the last, the highest ranking Nazi criminal living. And one of the things that is surprising about the play is that Simon Wiesenthal had an enormous sense of humor. So you were talking about fun and frolicking musicals. I wouldn't say this is frolicking, but people wind up laughing as much as they do. They wind up laughing as much as they cry.
Yeah.
So it's an odd thing, but Holocaust survivors often have excellent sense of humor.
I would think that, you know, having a sense of humor, having being able to laugh helps to lessen the pain after even after all of these years.
I think even during, I know, because I've read so much about it, during the Holocaust, when people who were in these concentration camps, they had a sense of humor with each other, and life went on.
Yeah.
And I think it's a fascinating story of triumph, even within, you know, the concentration camps, where they would laugh, they would play games, they would do whatever they could in this horrible, horrible situation to bring their mind and their heart back to some form of normalcy.
Yeah,
it's something else. It really is. To consider that people got married.
Yeah.
You know.
You know, interesting that you bring up the humor part of this, because I was going to ask you. I'm always very curious when there's any kind of a movie or theatrical work that is of a very serious subject matter. You know, how people put themselves through you know, that very difficult process. But it is, I guess, it's part of the act of never forgetting. So we never repeat, that we're reminded of the horror, and in some kind of catharsis, maybe to you know, try to put you know, this horrible act of dishumanity to rest someplace.
You know, one of the most important things about doing this play is to take that subject. Which I think is unmanageable for most of us. We understand that it happened. We can't imagine how it happened. We can't imagine so many things. But my job is to try to make the subject of the Holocaust manageable for your average person. I'm an average person. So that's my job, but it was also, of course, Wiesenthal's job, because that's all I'm doing, is I'm trying to reflect his work. He put it into manageable terms where you can imagine yourself in that situation. And it's not so very, very overwhelming that we couldn't even dream of it, you know? I don't know if I'm getting the point across clearly, but what I'll tell you is that people who lived through the Holocaust come to see the play, and they shake their heads, yes, this is, yep. And they say that, you know, because they know everything there is to know,
right,
about the Holocaust, and they were still entertained. Keep in mind, this is a play that it's not a lecture; it's an entertainment.
Yeah.
So people are able to. Excuse me, I'm so sorry. Hold on.
Come back later.
Like somebody was knocking on the door.
I'm in a hotel. And the maid, the cleaning lady, is trying to get in. So,
room service.
Yeah, right.
I know that feeling. I've been on the air from hotel rooms as well, where that's when they decide to make up the room at that moment, even though you have a do not disturb sign on the door. I know exactly exactly what you mean. The play sounds.
My point.
Yes.
My point was that students, who are my favorite audience. Students, I think it's appropriate for junior high school and up. They don't, even if they don't know anything about the Holocaust, they come and see the show, and they do get a comprehensive understanding of what happened, how it happened, and why it happened.
Yeah, it sounds incredibly enlightening. Wiesenthal is the name of the play at the North Shore Center for Performing Arts in Skokie. It will be playing June 26th, which is next Wednesday, through June 30th, Wednesday through Sunday. And you can get more information. You can purchase tickets through their box office, 847-673-6300 at northshorecenter.org. Or you can get more information at wiesenthaltheshow.com. Tom Dugan is Simon Wiesenthal. He is the playwright. He's the director. I'm glad you could join us this morning. I really appreciate it.
Oh, thank you so much, and I hope to meet you when you come to see the show.
I am going to, it's a super busy week, but I'm going to really try to work it in, because it sounds absolutely compelling to me. Thank you, Tom. I appreciate it.
Bye-bye.
You've got a friend in me. You've got a friend in me.
How long have we been friends, Shawnee?
Well, we've known each other for... since 1981.
Wow. Wasn't buddies that whole time.
That's right. Pals. So 1981, what is that, 37 years, 38 years.
Ooh, doggies. I was just a teenager.
38 years.
Yeah. And his false teeth. What was your movie question that you had?
Oh, seriously, the movie question I have, it's, I find this intriguing. I've seen the trailer and the promotion for the movie called Yesterday.
Oh, boy.
I'm waiting for this.
I've seen it.
I like the interesting premise.
I've seen it, and I loved
it. You've seen the movie?
Seen it, and I've loved it.
Okay. All right.
Here's the premise. Here's the premise. I'm going to pause my Toy Story music for a second. I'm going to get to the box office numbers in a second. But let me tell you about this movie called Yesterday. The premise is that there is this guy who's kind of a coffee house musician. Not overly successful, but, you know, he plays the guitar and sings in coffee houses. There is a worldwide power strike, and all the power goes out for a little while. He's involved in an accident, so it winds up being okay. But when he wakes up from the accident, he is the only person, he thinks he's the only person in the world that has any memory whatsoever of the Beatles.
Now, this is piquing my interest.
He wakes up and, you know, he goes to the coffee house and he starts playing, I forget what Beatles song, like Yesterday or, you know, some Beatles song that everybody on earth knows. He plays and people are like, wow, what's that song? What is that? You know, and he's you know, begins to learn that there is no cognizance whatsoever of who the Beatles were and are and their songs and anything. And, you know, he builds a career out of playing Beatles songs, and people think he's a genius. And, you know, he's playing like the biggest venues in the world with these songs that are the Beatles catalog, but nobody knows it's the Beatles catalog. Everyone thinks
these
are
fascinating
songs that he has written, Long and Winding Road and Let It Be and, you know, Paperback Writer, Eleanor Rigby. You know, name the song. It's a charming, charming, lovely movie that is, it's about all of that, but really this movie also is about what if certain things never happened? How would the world be different if certain things never happened? Like certain things in your life never happened. There's one scene in particular with, well, I don't even want to say what that is because that would be a spoiler.
It opens this week, right?
It opens this coming Friday.
Friday, yeah.
This coming Friday. And I'm going to give it a Dean's List A.
Wow.
I loved it. It's so charming. So, so, so charming. Yeah, I'll tell you more about it toward the end of the week for sure. But, oh, I'm glad. I knew you would be interested in that.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yeah, when I saw the trailer and all the information about it, I thought, wow, this is intriguing.
Very, very interesting concept on that. And this Toy Story 4 that opened on Friday massacred at the box office. As you might imagine, Toy Story 4 took in $118 million. Since it opened on Friday. I gave that a Dean's List A. It's very charming and funny and touching and really nice storylines about friendship and loyalty. And, you know, Pixar, nobody does it better than Pixar. It's, you know, just that simple. And they continue their superiority with the Toy Story franchise. I thought it was done, finished, and over with beautifully at Toy Story 3. But they find a way to continue the story without cheapening it in any way. It's also very beautiful. Bring some Kleenex when you go to see that one as well. A huge box office weekend for them. Talking about movies, we've got a big night coming up at Ravinia on July the 12th. We are going to be hosting the evening of West Side Story, where they're going to show the original film on big screens throughout Ravinia, and the Chicago Symphony Orchestra will play the score live. These movie nights they do are phenomenal, and I'm very, very happy to be back to hold a pre-show discussion. They set up a little stage, and I talk about the movie and give you a little facts you may not have known about the movie, and they set up on these video screens, they put up what they call a Twitter board, and people can tweet questions onto the board, and I look up at the board and I see your question and I answer your question. We have such a fun night. I get to meet you, and we chat and take pictures, and it's a really, really fun night. So I hope you can come out and join us. It's at Ravinia in Highland Park, July 12th. the Oscar-winning West Side Story with the score played live by the Chicago Symphony Orchestra. And I've got some tickets to give away. We've got 5 pair of tickets to give away. We didn't really talk about how we're going to give the tickets away, but let's do this. Let's start at caller number 5. We'll take callers 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9. 5, 6, 7, 8, and 9. And you give me a compelling reason why I should give you a pair of tickets. That's how easy this is going to be today. Just give me a good compelling reason. We'll pass along some tickets here today so you can join us. Pavilion seats, by the way, to join us for this. 312-981-7200 WGN. From where are you calling, Kathy?
Hi, Dean. Kathy from Arlington Heights.
Nice to have you with us. Good morning.
Love you. WGN since Wally Phillips was my mom in the kitchen since 19, God knows. So,
thank you.
Yeah, long time.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you. So I've got these tickets to see West Side Story to join me at Ravinia on July the 12th. We'll see the movie West Side Story up on big screen. The Chicago Symphony Orchestra will play the score live. Just give me a compelling reason why I should give you a pair of tickets to this.
My husband, this is a fact, was in college, Carthage College, plays in the play. He was a jet. So I'm sure he had a lot of makeup. So he played the role of a jet, and we just love West Side Story.
You're going. Pavilion seats for you, Kathy.
Husband Tom, thank you.
That's right. If you want to take them, that's entirely up to you. I appreciate your call. Hang on a second. This is Nancy in Downers Grove.
Yes.
Good morning. How are you this morning?
If I were better, I'd be twins.
Well, look at that. Look at that. Then you could take yourself to go see West Side Story.
My compelling story is that 5 of my girlfriends and I used to produce the West Side Story every single day after school, and they were all of the jets, and I was all of the sharks. Just me by myself, the sharks and Maria.
Wow. Oh, so you were Maria also.
Well, yes, I can sing, so.
Can you give me a little of I Feel Pretty?
I feel pretty, oh so pretty. I feel pretty and witty and wise.
You have a lovely singing voice. Very, very,
thank you.
Very lovely
thank
singing
you.
Voice. And I've got a pair thank of you. Pavilion seats for you, Nancy. I look forward to seeing you out there. Jean, good morning. You're on WGN. Are you there, Jean? Oh, wait a second.
Oh, I am.
Yeah, there
hi.
You go.
Yeah. Hi, I'm here.
And
yes.
Hoffman
I was listening to her singing.
I know you. I was mesmerized as well. I was,
yeah. It's hard to follow that act.
It's like it hypnotized me. But you don't have to sing if you don't want to.
Okay,
you
good.
All you have to do is give me
you
a...
You don't want me to.
Just give me a compelling reason why I should give you a pair of tickets to join us.
I love West Side Story, and I would just really like to go.
That's good enough for me. That is good enough for me.
Thanks.
So. Gene, we'll see you out there as well. Make sure you say hello. And Kathy, also from Hoffman Estates. Hi, you're on WGN.
Hi, good morning. How are you?
Very well. And tell me, are you a fan of West Side Story?
I am a fan. I actually grew up on the west side of Chicago, so I just remember enjoying watching the show on TV. I love the story. I love the singing.
Very nice. What's your favorite song in the show?
Oh, there's too many to list. I enjoy them all.
Okay. All right. Well, I expect to hear you singing loudly then that night. I'm going to get you a pair of pavilion seats to join us as well. Okay?
Sounds great. Thank you.
Anybody can get tickets by going to ravinia.org. Hang on for just 1 second. Ariel will get all the info from you. We'll take a break and update news next. WGN. I'd said that we had 5 pair of tickets to give away to join me at West Side Story at Ravinia on July 12th. We gave away 4. Don, you are going to be number 5. How's that?
Hey, that sounds great to me.
Yeah, well, give me a compelling reason why I should give you a pair of tickets to join us.
Well, 3 reasons, actually.
Oh,
number 1, it's my wife's favorite musical.
Okay.
Number 2, we're celebrating our 50th wedding anniversary in a week.
Wow.
And number 3, my wife used to work at WGN about 40 years ago.
What was your wife's name?
Carol Peterson. She worked in the accounting department for Jim Feely. I'm sure he's probably dearly departed by now.
Yeah, that may have been a little bit before me, but yeah, well, happy to take care of one of our WGN alums to join us. Happy anniversary to you. That's fantastic.
Yeah, great. Thanks.
Yeah, and let's get you a pair of pavilion seats to join us out on July the 12th to see the Oscar-winning movie and the Chicago Symphony Orchestra play the score live. Oh. You're going to have a great time, and I hope you'll we can say hi when we're out there, okay?
Hey, that'd be great. We love the Ravinia. We haven't been there in quite a while, though, because it's getting so crowded out there.
Well, you're going to be all set in the pavilion. Hang on for a quick second here, and we'll get all the information from you. In the meantime, let's get an update of news sponsored by Executive Green Carpet Cleaning. And here is Dave Schwann. Mama don't want you. Daddy don't want you. Give it up, baby, baby. Mama can't buy you love. Mama don't want you. Daddy don't need you. Funny, this is my favorite Elton John song. Of all of his hits.
Is this in Rocket Man?
This one is not in Rocket Man.
No.
This was not as big of a hit as the song Rocket Man or Your Song or, you know,
Benny and the Jets.
Benny and the Jets, Honky. This is, but I still like it. I don't know. There's something
good song.
About the song that
good.
I really like.
Yeah. Philadelphia Freedom. Remember that one?
Right, right. And as you know, I have seen to this day, you know, I don't want to brag about being an Elton John fan, but I have seen 3 of his concerts. That's the kind
now,
of
now. What kind of a lead-in might this be for?
That is the kind of super fan that I am. I have gone to 3 shows, all in the same city. I might add, I have 0 memorabilia at home. That's the kind of Elton John fan that I am. Try to top that, Elton Jim, Toronto.
I remember when we got a promotional copy of Captain Fantastic and the Brown Dirt Cowboy at the radio station I worked at.
Yeah, I didn't save any of that stuff. I'm sure I'm sure Jim Toronto's having a heart attack that I never saved.
Oh, my gosh, 3 shows. I achieved that by the time I was 15.
In 1 week. In 1 week.
Exactly, yeah. Over from a Thursday to a Saturday.
Hi, Elton Jim.
Hey, Dino Reno, I just want to say, boy, I've been listening to the show all morning, per usual. Boy, you listen to you, Mr. Rock and Roll Rolling Stones fan, you.
How about that? And yet,
wow, you seem to even know the hits.
Even.
I heard you singing Start Me Up. I don't know what key you were in.
It doesn't matter.
It sounded okay.
Jim, in rock and roll, we don't need to be in key. We just need to have this. We rock and roll singers.
I heard you two celebrate are going to have heart valve surgery this week. I think that's great as a fan.
Yeah, because of my affection for Jim, Mick, rather.
Right.
I am going to have a heart valve replaced.
Yeah, you don't want to have moves like Jagger. You want to have valves like Jagger.
Yeah, exactly. It's just a matter of time till I have to have the surgery anyway. I may as well have it done now. That's what I'm thinking.
Yeah, no, in fact, while the rest of the city was rocking out at Soldier Field, I was at your previously mentioned Ravinia on Friday night.
Yeah.
Enjoying the cool sounds of a classy cat named Tony Bennett.
Yeah, I had some commitments on Friday night, so I could go to neither the Rolling Stones nor Tony Bennett. It killed me. And Hugh Jackman was in town, and I really wanted to see his show. In fact, Hugh Jackman thanked the crowd. He was at United Center. And he had a very respectable crowd at the United Center doing basically a huge Broadway show of the music that he likes to perform, singing and dancing.
Well, that's cool. Yeah, well, if you were showing or having another live performance, the Stones clearly were going to be, you know, definitely inching in on your crowd, on your crowds. But I have to tell you, Tony, for almost 93 years old, he came out and he had a skip in his step. He had a smile from ear to ear. And I'll tell you, he hit some notes that clearly, Dean, you could never hit.
In my best day.
Yeah.
Not to mention, I'm 92.
And the best part of him is even, you know, what's great about him is he knows his limitations as a singer, because you know when you're going to hit that note or not, but he has a way of just, when he's getting up there, maybe it's not going to be there, he finds a way to turn it and twist it.
Right.
And it just sounds great, and I'll tell you, he looks like he is having the time of his life, and here he is almost 93 years old. It was a great evening at Ravinia.
I've seen him perform many times as well, and in addition to that, of you know, being able to use his voice the way that he does.
Yeah.
When he sings a song, he makes you feel those lyrics. Nobody can interpret song lyrics and make you feel the sentiment of a song the way that Tony Bennett can. He is truly one of the most amazing vocalists.
Yeah, I mean, if you haven't had a chance to see him, please do, because who knows how much longer we have to see him. But like I said, he came out skipping, and I'm sitting there going, geez, I wonder what it's going to be like. I mean, hey, 93 years old is 93 years old,
is
right?
Is it true that he started off his show singing Start Me Up?
No, he did Jumping Jack Flash.
How cool would that be
he was so great too. The best thing is that there's a moment when he sings where he holds the microphone in two hands.
Yeah.
Like and with his head down, you could just see he's so into it.
Right.
It's just so great to watch somebody
who
is doing exactly what they were meant to do.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. How cool would it be if somehow they were able to, with a helicopter or something, and the Stones join Tony Bennett, or Tony Bennett comes and joins the Stones? I bet that would be one of the coolest things in the world, to have Tony doing some jazz, to have Tony doing.
Important to make a case.
Nobody can hear me today. Nobody can hear me today.
Talking about how the influence that the Chicago Blues had on a young Mick Jagger and a young Keith Richards, and basically, you know, led to the founding of this band, you know, almost, you know, 60 years ago.
Yeah.
But the funny part is, in Chicago, Dean, you need to get on top of this, because you are a mover and shaker. You embrace and touch people all around the city here. We need to embrace our blues history. The Chess Studios should be a national landmark.
That's true.
There should be a blues Chicago Blues Row where tourists can go, like Beale Street in Memphis. I mean, we talk about the Chicago Blues. Other peoples from other countries are loving the Chicago Blues, and yet when you come here to Chicago, there's not really a spot or a place where, there should be a statue to Willie Dixon and a statue to Muddy Waters.
They sort of have
that in Chicago.
They
talk about it.
Hello, testing.
I'm on my soapbox because it should be one of our greatest things to draw people here.
Jim, calm down. Calm down.
Well,
come back
in. Come on, Dean. It's been 80 years.
Come back in off the ledge of the building, Jim. Step inside of the building. Calm down. I was at Chess Records on Friday. I was at 2120.
Oh, I've never been there. That'd be so cool.
Stop interrupting me. 2120 South Michigan Avenue, the original site of Chess Records, and there's a photographic exhibit up there right now of when the Rolling Stones came to Chess to record. I was in the actual recording studio where the Stones, Muddy Water, Chuck Berry, Etta James, go down the list of all the legendary people and all the reasons, as Jim rightfully says, that should be some kind of blues museum, and there should be some commemoration of the significance of Chicago blues. To be in that building it's a very important place in Chicago in music history. Period.
And, exactly, in music history, not just Chicago history, in music history.
Very definitely. So
I've been to, as I said before, to Memphis, and I went to Sun Records with Elvis and Jerry Lee Lewis, recorded their first songs. And as you said, you walk in there, and it's almost like a shrine, and they do it right there. And like I said, I think we should, it's about time that Chicago embraces that, because it is a huge part of our city's history that should be, transplanted throughout the world to let people know that there's a place to come and see where this great music was discovered. It's not discovered, but certainly it came to its prominence.
That's 1,000%. I couldn't agree with you more. And Willie Dixon's daughter, Jacqueline, now runs the place. They own it. And that's exactly what she wants to happen. So we're going to keep an eye on it.
Mayor Lightfoot will get this the ball rolling on this because, as I said, from a tourism standpoint, from a historical standpoint, Chicago blues is known throughout the world, and yet it's really not known in Chicago.
Very true. Very true. Jim, why are you so excited today?
I'm always excited to talk to a Dean Richards.
Did you drink a lot of Coke today?
You've been always generous to allow me a little few moments on your show.
Did you have too much coffee today? Can you not hear me? Do you have an earpiece on your phone? Can you not hear me when I'm talking?
Oh, I'm sorry. Why am I?
Because I'm talking and you're not.
Oh, I'm sorry. No, I'm.
Something changed on your phone. You don't sound as distorted now either.
Oh, okay. I'm sorry.
Are you on that cheap flip phone that you have?
No, I'm actually on a landline.
Oh, okay.
I have a landline, too, and a flip phone.
Okay. We're going to give Jim some Valium because this actually is not the reason why he's on the show today. He's in a play, and you can tell if you want to spend a relaxing evening not having somebody shouting at you, you want to go see Jim's play. Let me take a break. We'll let the Valium take effect.
I wouldn't mind. I don't even feel like I'm. I wait till you see me hyped up.
Have a seat, Jim. Relax.
All right. I'm in my recliner right now.
I'm going to send you some old tapes of me on WNUA. That's enough to put anyone to sleep.
Smooth Dean.
Jim's in a play. That's what we're going to talk about when we come back in a second.
Catch your seat, just like guys. Look out. Here comes the Spider-Man.
Coming up after 12 o'clock, talking with the new Spider-Man, Tom Holland, was in London this past week, interviewed the entire cast of the new Spider-Man movie, Far From Home. And we'll share the Tom Holland interview with you after 12 o'clock right here on this show. But all this week on the WGN-TV Morning News, we'll be sharing interviews with the cast of the new Spider-Man movie, which I really liked, by the way. Really, really liked it. Jim, are you a fan of the Marvel movies? I can't remember. I know you spend most...
I'm a somewhat fan, but I'm not a big comic book fan, although that song you're playing in the background,
yeah.
Oh my gosh, I remember watching Spider-Man,
yeah.
Hulk, Thor on Channel 26. They used to have the original cartoons. I could barely get Channel 26
right.
On my UHF TV, but I remember that song. Life is a great big hang up. Whenever you're a hang up, you need the Spider-Man.
I used to watch Channel 26 back in the day because I liked Stock Market Observer.
Well, you were always more of an egghead.
I was more of a financial person.
Yeah, you've always been a
even back
a bull.
Then. So Jim, Elton Jim Toronto is with us. Because he's been getting such really good reviews in the plays that he's been in over the past couple of years now, I guess. And you've got another one that is coming next weekend, right?
Yeah, I just wanted to talk about this because it's a very short run. It's just three performances on a Friday and a Saturday, but we're doing it out with a group called the Summer Place Theater in Naperville. And it'll be at a beautiful venue called the Yellow Box Theater right near downtown Naperville off of Ogden. But the play is called My Three Angels, and if you may remember, Dean, you're a movie fanatic and critic, there was a great film in the 1950s starring Humphrey Bogart and Peter Ustinov and Basil Rathbone called We're No Angels,
right.
About three convicts who get involved with they're on Devil's Island in French Guiana, and they get involved with a family, and it's a comedy. It's even a Christmas story. It happens at Christmas time. It's a very fun, heartfelt comedy, and I'm lucky enough to play the Bogart role. And so it's just a fun kind of, farcical, silly, some great lines, some crazy, different circumstances, and also a little chance to have a Christmas in July, even though it's end of June. But Friday and Saturday, June 28th at 7:30 and June 29th, two shows, an afternoon show at 2 and then an evening show at 7:30. As I said, at the Yellow Box Theater in Naperville, and if you want tickets, it's you go to Summer Place Theater, theatre.org, summerplacetheater.org, or the phone number is 630-355-7969.
Do you do the role in a Bogart sort of way?
No, I know, I know. You know, Dean, I try to bring my own interpretation to the role, although yes. I do try to I'm one of these actors, if you can call me an actor, even though I have been acting for about 15 years.
I like
years
to now. Call you a thespian.
Yeah, a thespian. But
Happy Pride Month.
I actually do like to watch, if I'm doing a play that has been done before, and it's a movie version or something, I will watch previous actors just to see what they brought to it. I talk to any actor, and everyone steals from everyone. So you don't want to do it exactly the way, but there might be one little moment you go, well, that's really a great moment, and it deserves to be in this play, and that character should do it, and maybe I never would have thought of it. But no, I bring my own interpretation to it, but hopefully there's a few little touches, if you've seen the movie, that you may remember, that I do try to give a little nod to Bogey.
Very nice, very nice. So that's going to be next weekend. Give us the website for info and tickets.
Yes, once again, it's Summer Place Theater, and theater with an R-E, .org. Phone number is 630-355-7969. And once again, it's My Three Angels, and it's directed by Craig Gustafson, who I was also acted with in Glengarry Glen Ross last summer. So it's nice to be back with him. And I've been playing some villains in the last year or so, so it's been fun to just let my comic side and flex those muscles too. So it's going to be a fun show.
I think it's fun.
I'm going to rehearsals in a couple hours now, yeah. And we open on Friday.
Very good. I think it's fun that you're enjoying this, and people seem to be enjoying it as well. I know that when you were doing work with the North Riverside Players, and you guys won an award, didn't you?
Yeah, that was
theater
cool.
Award.
Yeah, that was very cool. We did a production of The Crucible, Arthur Miller's Crucible, which is one of his great plays about the Salem witch trials, and I played the main heavy, if you will, the judge, Judge Danforth, who hangs the witches. And then later, we did that in October of last year, and this year, in March, we did a scene from the play in a competition for the Illinois Theater Association, and not only did our scene was one of the co-winners of the competition, but I was awarded the award for outstanding performance
yeah.
during that competition.
Yeah, very nice.
So that was very cool. I had no idea they even gave it out. It was a great honor, and so yeah, I've always enjoyed this. I mean, radio is my first love, obviously, but I have to do something to stay busy. Some of the hours of the day, and so this has certainly been something that I've enjoyed for quite a while, and people seem to like it too. And talking about it on the air, as I said many times, people will come up to me after a show and say, "Hey, I heard you talk about it on Dean," and that was the only reason that they heard about it or came. So once again, I thank you for your generosity.
And one of these days, I'm going to come and see one of the plays as well.
I would love for you to do that.
I've
that would be great,
been,
and maybe
I've
you could
so
you know
busy.
Announce it, and then you could be my plus one.
I don't want to open the door in any way of you saying, now I owe you. So that's never going to happen. All right. Jim, have a lovely Sunday, won't you, please?
You too, Dean. And you, don't forget, you can always start me up.
Wow. Have a nice day.
Okay, Dean Areno. Take it easy.
Talking about things that are going on today, we've got the Cirque du Soleil that's going on. We've got the Taste of Joliet that is going on today until 8 o'clock. Melissa Etheridge, who we're listening to right now, is at Ravinia tonight with George Thorogood and the Destroyers. That's going to be a fun show. Somebody had texted in, Shwani, asking, I'm going to Ravinia for the first time. Any suggestions? So I told them,
leave,
you know,
allow extra yeah, travel time.
Leave right now.
Yeah.
Leave right now.
Allow extra travel time.
It does get very busy. And, you know, once the nearby parking lots fill up, then you have to go to the remote parking lots and they use
yes.
shuttle buses to bring you in. It does take a long time to get in and out.
I will never forget one time when the car in front of me took the very last parking. I mean, the final space in a remote lot, one of the extension satellite lots. And the person waving in the traffic looked at me, put up their hands and said, sorry, we're full.
Oh, wow. What'd you do?
We ended up parking
in Milwaukee.
Yeah. And actually parking somewhere in Highland Park. probably in a tow zone, hoping and praying that the car wouldn't be towed. Right. It wasn't, but it was a bit of a walk to get back to the park.
Well, I suggested,
we made it, though.
I suggested to this person, if you're near the Metra, just get on the Metra. It drops you off right at the front gate.
At the front gate.
It's the easiest way to get to Ravinia.
Yeah. Those trains can be crowded, but
they have extra trains for the show, though.
And they have extra trains. But, you know, you're right, though. You know, if it is crowded, just kind of hang in there. And when you get off, you will thank yourself for not having to worry about the parking lot.
It's a short walk. And if you've never been to Ravinia, you can buy food while you're there, of course. But the beautiful part about Ravinia is you can put a blanket out. You can, you know, bring your own food. Put out a little picnic and enjoy the music while you're out there. So have a great time for those shows. When we had meteorologist Mike Hamernick on earlier, he said looked like the rain was going to happen. The major part of the rain was going to happen before the many concerts that are going on tonight. At Pride Fest today at 9 o'clock, Leanne Rimes is going to be performing. That's a huge name for that, and 16 Candles. Big Chicago favorite, all performing tonight at Pride Fest at the Country Lake Shake that is at Northerly Island. Luke Bryan, country star, Clint Black, Mitchell Tenpenny, John Langston, all performing there tonight. So there is plenty to do tonight. And when we come back from a quick break, we've got my one-on-one interviews with the new Spider-Man. I was in London for several days this past week. Interviewed the whole cast of the new Spider-Man Far From Home. I'll tell you a little bit about the movie. We'll share my interview with the stars coming up next, WGN. Spider-Man. 12:23, Dean Richards, WGN, and a bonus Dean Richards Sunday morning show this week. Going all the way till 1:30, we'll get to our Food Time show starting at 12:30 today with horticulture expert Jim Fazell. But wanted to share a special interview with you that I did this past week when I was in London, England, interviewing the cast of the new Spider-Man movie that'll be coming out in about 10 days, Spider-Man Far From Home, that recaptures, I think, the spirit of the original Spider-Man movies that you may have been introduced to, either on television or the first Tobey Maguire movie. This one stars an English actor named Tom Holland. Same kind of a premise, but the storyline is kind of a handoff from Avengers Endgame. For the many, many, many of you that went to and became obsessed with Avengers Endgame, although I know plenty of you are not interested in superhero movies at all, but for those of you who did go to see Avengers Endgame, you know what happened. And this one kind of continues the Spider-Man story based on that. It's sort of a handoff from Endgame, which I thought was very, very interesting. It's really fun. It's really exciting. The actors do a great job. Jake Gyllenhaal is featured in the movie, Samuel L. Jackson. And the trio that I have for you now, which includes Spider-Man himself, Tom Holland, but also Zendaya, actress, fashion model, singer. She plays Michelle Jones in the movie. And Peter Parker's buddy Ned is played by an actor named Jacob Batalon. And we'll start the conversation there. Is there a level of difficulty having a movie that is tagging on to Endgame? A certain amount of pressure?
There are difficulties, and then there are massive plus sides. You know, like people after the end of Endgame want to know what happens next, and our film is the next, you know? But then there's also the pressure of Endgame, I think, is the greatest superhero movie of all time, and everyone loved it so much, so we have an expectation to kind of live up to that, and I think John Watts and his team and us as actors in this film really have done that. It comes with its own kind of level of pressure, and also its definite upside.
And I can't think of a movie that is so full of spoilers.
Yeah.
As I was thinking about this.
Tell us about it.
I can imagine for you, even worse. But, you know, how am I going to review this? How am I going to explain this?
Without ruining
anything. There's nothing I can say that won't
Clever. Yeah. Keep the interview short.
Have you had difficulties like that?
Yeah, I think all of us have. I mean, it's we're lucky that we're all friends. So, you know, when we need to talk to somebody about all the exciting stuff that's going on, we can just talk to each other and not get in trouble for it. But it's so much fun. And I think, you know, also a great part of this movie is because there's kind of, I don't know about anybody else, but Endgame is very tragic, I think, for a lot of people and dramatic. I think although this movie does deal with those things and, you know, has those moments, it also has just a lot of fun. A lot of humor, and allows, I think, for us to just like kind of look at that same experience through a comedic lens sometimes. Yeah. So it's kind of like a little bit of a weight off, I think, and just kind of mend people's hearts a little bit.
Yeah,
one of the
things that I enjoyed so much about this is that it's like true to the original Spider-Man spirit of fun and adventure.
Yeah.
You know, very true to the original Marvel concept of what the comic books were like back in the day.
Mm-hmm. I think that's what we're trying to do. I think it's great when you can pull from the comics and stuff like that.
But, John made like a really strong point of that he was going to stay true to the tone that he created in the first film, while dealing with the ramifications of Endgame, which makes for a lot of humor.
Yeah.
You know, he kind of looked at a crazy situation. Like, imagine if the world did just disappear for 5 years and you came back. There are some funny stories to be told there, for sure.
Can't come out of the trap.
Yeah, I think John's really good at like making movies that feel new and current and fun, but also have like a nostalgia to them as
well. Yeah, of course.
You know?
Yeah.
So it's hard to do.
One of the most relatable threads of this whole movie is the teen angst that Spider-Man is, that Peter is going through with this of, you know, romance and being conflicted between responsibility and wanting to have fun and relax. How closely does that mirror what you may have all gone through?
I feel like everyone's gone through puberty.
So it's what makes these films so interesting, because, you know, Tony Stark's a billionaire. There's only a few thousand billionaires in the world. Thor's a god, you know. There's not many of those around. Captain America's a super soldier.
Peter's a kid,
you know. Yeah. So it's nice because if you can't relate to Peter Parker, then you can relate to MJ. And if you can't relate to MJ, then you can relate to Ned. And there's so many, it's such a diverse cast, and we're able to kind of relate to everyone around the world. And what I love about this film is I watched it with my parents, my brothers, and obviously my parents laughed at some jokes, my older brothers and I laughed at other jokes, and then my younger brother, Paddy, laughed at some jokes.
Interesting.
So,
a little older
brothers
for
not older than me, but they're...
Yeah.
Whatever.
What I found interesting on the teen angst, just came from talking to Sam Jackson, who is arguably the coolest guy in the world, who you would think would never have any angst whatsoever in his life. And he admitted to finding the teen romance aspect. I guess everybody goes through that, right?
Of course. Yeah. Like, adolescence is, awkward.
Yeah.
Completely honest, you know. And I also think that, like, I think in weird ways you can kind of relate, I think... I don't know if you've ever thought about this or think about it sometimes, but like you kind of live a double life as like a public superhero, and then you're Tom at the end of the day too. So like I think, you know, all of us kind of feel that as well. I mean, there's things that I've had to like grow up having a career and then also just wanting to be a kid. So it's like, dang, I feel that, you know, sometimes you want to just go do the kid stuff and you can't because, you know, you got work to do.
There is Zendaya, singer, actress. Also, Jacob Batalon, who is Ned, Peter Parker's best friend, and, of course, 23-year-old British actor Tom Holland. You would never know that he's British with his extremely American accent that he has as Peter Parker, Spider-Man, in this new movie, Far From Home, which I will be giving a very good review. I really enjoyed it. I'll tell you much more about it between now and then. We'll show you the interviews on the WGN-TV Morning News. Take a quick break, update your news, and then... We've got our Food Time show today, growing stuff in your yard. Jim Fazell, for decades, has been the expert here on WGN, and he joins us next, WGN.
I beg your pardon. I never promised you a rose garden.
For decades here on WGN, you would hear the great Jim Fazell, featured with Orion Samuelson and Max Armstrong on our noontime farm show, agriculture shows, talking about how to take care of your rose gardens and gardens in general. anything that grew. Jim is a nationally known horticulture consultant and expert to this day. And Jim, it's an honor to have you back with us on WGN. How are you, my friend?
Well, I'm good, Dean. It's been a long time since we visited. It's nice to get together with you.
I gotta say, no matter how many years go by, you sound exactly the same.
Uh-oh.
That's a good thing.
Well, it's Ori, and I'm trying to catch him, and he and I just keep rolling along here like the surf on the seashore.
Well, I'll tell you what, as long as you're both delivering with such energy, why not? It's great to talk to you, and I thought that this would be a good Sunday to, you know, people's gardens are, for the most part, up and running.
Finally, right.
Yeah,
exactly.
Finally, with all this weather, I thought we'd open up the phone lines, take some questions for you, as always. With all of this weather, the chillier weather that we've had and all this rainy weather, what kinds of problems might gardeners have this year?
Well, we are having problems with everything being late. Also, with the amount of moisture that we had, it was just terrible trying to get in. The farmers aren't the only ones that have had trouble getting in, and a lot of us have had flooded yards and flooded gardens, just too wet to do anything. But finally, we've had a few days when we could get things done. I know out in the farm fields, the farmers have gotten some things done. But the other thing that's interesting, you know, we keep track of the degree days, and these are crop degree days. But if you're north of about the line from Champaign over to the Mississippi River, our temperatures have been running below normal. We've accumulated fewer degree days than we should have, and from there south, they're above normal, so they're ahead. But even at that, where they're ahead down there, they couldn't get planted because it was too wet. So anyway, let's just hope that the weather warms up. It looks like this coming week we're going to get some temperatures that are about normal, or maybe slightly above for once, especially in this area.
Now, will people experience any kind of special problems because of excessively moist ground?
Well, we're having some problems, definitely. We've had a lot of plant material that drowned, things that were planted early that subsequently got flooded. A lot of that stuff has drowned, and people have had to do some replanting. We also have a real problem with foliar diseases. When we've had as much moisture as we've had, a lot of plants that get foliar diseases are showing them at this time. Generally, when that happens, those leaves will they're going to die off, and they will be dropped in many cases. But if the weather dries out, a lot of these plants will recover and make normal leaves. For instance, there's a sycamore. I can see it out of my office. That sycamore just now is beginning to get some leaves on it, not because it didn't try, but because it gets a disease called sycamore anthracnose that kills them as they open. Now that we're beginning to get a little bit warmer weather, drier weather, those trees are actually beginning to make leaves now, and they may, if we don't get a lot more moisture and cool weather, may go ahead and fully foliate for the rest of the season. That's normally the progress of these kinds of trees. But there are a lot of other plant materials that suffer from leaf spots. You know, the ivy on the walls down there at Wrigley, that Boston ivy, that's one that gets leaf spot really severely. And I know that the guys down there, as soon as they get wet weather like this and the leaves begin to come out, they get the fungicides out and begin covering those things to protect
really?
them, because we want to see green along those walls.
Right. I tried to copy that and grow some fern, ivy rather, in my yard, and I must have gotten that because it was a complete disaster and failure several years ago. I've switched. I'm going to start the questions off with one that I have with some beautiful clematis plants that I love. I have three of them. Two of them are doing beautifully and climbing like crazy and getting ready to flower. I can tell one of them just is not doing anything. Same kind of soil, same kind of treatment, same everything. What might be going on there?
Well, is it, has it started to grow at all, or is it just not coming back from winter?
Yeah, kind of. Well, it's a little bit, but it's just interesting to me that two of them are thriving, and one of them is just like barely hanging on. I'm worried about it.
Well, several things could happen. You know, even though we think they're planted in similar soils, there could be a difference in drainage, could be a difference in soil, something could be buried under there. That's one possibility. Also, there's a lot of differences in cultivars, varieties. Some of them tolerate our conditions better than others. Also, there are some stem rot diseases that will affect clematis. It may be that that particular plant has a stem rot disease, and it will affect it. It'll actually kill some of the stems off, but if you inspect the ones that are beginning to decline, you'll usually find an area on them where it's discolored. The stem is discolored. It may even be shrunken. That's one of the common problems with clematis. The other thing is they're very sensitive to soil pH. If you have one of your plants that happens to be growing in an area where the pH is very high because there's limestone buried or gravel buried or a chunk of concrete that was down there, yeah. That could affect the way it grows. The only way to find out is to examine the plant. My suspicion is that it's below ground. That's generally what we see. You might want to dig around it and see if there's something down there. If it's above ground, you're going to see the evidence on the stems, as I mentioned.
Right, right. So if it's something below, I need to get in there and try to dig it out?
Yeah, the best way to find out what's going on is to take a look, and you have to dig down to find. You know, you can't witch for problems on plants like you can
right.
witch for water.
Right,
so
right.
you have to do some digging.
All right. I'll do that. In the meantime, here is Kate, 312-981-7200. You're on WGN with Jim Fizell.
Hello, everyone. I'm so thrilled to talk to you, Jim. When I was growing up, in Chicago, my dad would have your reports on all the time, and I really think I absorbed that and subconsciously because I was very young, and I just turned out to love gardening and trees and planting in the woods and everything. So thank you for that.
Well, I'm glad. That's nice to hear because we talk year after year wondering whether people listen, and I know they do. But to hear somebody say, well, you influence what I'm doing, and I'm glad of that. That's why we're here.
I'm with you on that, Kate. I'm with you on that. Jim is the best.
Thanks. Yeah, wonderful. So thank you, really. Now, my old climbing roses thrived at the very beginning of the summer, maybe, you know, mid-May or so. Big, thick, lush bush, a very thick bush, nothing climbing. The leaves were yellow, so I figured too much water, naturally. But there were so many blooms, and they all bloomed so beautifully. The last 10 days, 2 weeks, the blooms, somebody turned the switch off. They're just all drying up. In the meantime, the shooters, the climbers, literally have shot up almost overnight, some of them. And they're very tall, I would say 5 feet, no bud, none. What do I do?
Well, a couple of things. Usually, climbing roses are not grafted, although that could be the case where you have a variety that's been grafted onto a rootstock. You need to make sure that the leaves that are on these canes that have come up are like the leaves on the canes that have flowered. If they're not, you cut them off because they're coming from the rootstock. Now, the other thing that's happened, we've had a lot of plant material that's very vigorous because of the amount of moisture, and some of them where we fertilize them are just making tremendous amounts of growth. If they do that, they're not going to stop to have a family. They're busy having fun growing. So the best thing to do with them is to wait till they harden off a little bit, and usually when that happens, they will make flower buds and will bloom for you. Now, if these are the climbing roses that generally bloom all year long, that's what will happen. They'll eventually make some buds and flower for you. So it's just a matter of waiting or checking to make sure that what you're growing is actually the variety that you expect it to be. So you need to do a little checking on that and see what's happening. It's not a disease problem. My guess is that you've got some rootstock that's growing in there, and it's a weed because it's not supposed to be the part that's growing. The top part that's growing is supposed to be the part that was grafted on. So we need to check on that.
Kate, good luck with all of that. We appreciate your call. We'll be back with more with Jim Fizell right after this. WGN today, horticulture consultant and expert, and you on the phones at 312-981-7200. Jim, we've got a bunch of texters with some questions. The 630 area code asking, I've got a 10-year-old wisteria that has never bloomed. It's in a fairly sunny spot. What should I do?
10-year-old wisteria, it's a baby.
Really?
Yeah, especially if it's, it could be very vigorous, but they make huge vines, and I know that a lot of people have tried to grow them. Sometimes you can get them to flower very early. You do that by keeping the nitrogen away from them. But if you plant them out in our regular soils here, which are pretty fertile, they're going to be anxious to grow instead of making flowers. But that's another situation. Those plants are going to flower. There's no question about it. But they can get huge. I know when I was a kid, we had one that covered the whole front of a great big house in Pasadena, California.
Yeah.
It was 30 feet wide and went up to the second story, so it was probably 15 feet tall. That's a mature one. The little ones are the ones that are 10 years old that are maybe 8 feet tall or something like that. But they'll flower. It's just a matter of time. If it's in a pretty good sunny location, that helps because it will generate excess carbohydrate in the storage system, which is what makes it flower. One thing you don't want to do not fertilize it. If you're going to put nitrogen fertilizer on it, you're going to tell it, look, buddy, I want you to make leaves, and it'll make leaves, but they're going to be at the expense of the flowers.
Okay. All right. That's good to know. Here's Joanne from Wheaton. You're on WGN with Jim Fizell.
Hi.
Hi, Joanne.
I have a hydrangea question. Thank you for taking my call. I have planted 2 years ago 4 hydrangeas in my front courtyard, and the first year, small blooms, the second year, no blooms, and this year, they're full of bloom. And the only thing that I did differently last year was put cocoa bean mulch down. Would that affect them? I haven't done it this year.
Well, cocoa bean mulch, actually, it is an organic mulch, and the organisms in the soil will decompose it, but they take nitrogen out of the soil to do that. I don't think that had any effect on how the plant bloomed. It's interesting. Those plants, I'm not sure which one you have. Some bloom on old wood, which means the wood that was produced the previous year. Some bloom on current wood, which means the green shoots that are coming out from the old stuff eventually make flowers. And there are some that will bloom on both. Now, part of the problem is if you have one or the other kind of that and you prune it at the wrong time, you're going to take the flower buds off. So you don't want to prune it any time late in the season. In fact, some of these, if you prune them in the wintertime, you're taking all the flower buds off. So you need to find out for sure which kind it is, the one that blooms on old wood or the one that blooms on new wood, then and treat it accordingly.
Okay, great.
Thank you for the call.
I was curious about the cocoa bean, that's all.
Yeah.
No, that had no effect on it.
Thanks for that.
Okay, all right, great.
Thank you, Joanne. Jim, when we come back from the break, I want to ask you about what we should be doing with our tomato plants that everybody is putting out in the backyard. We'll talk more with horticulture expert Jim Fizell after a quick break. WGN.
I'd like to be under the sea in an octopus's garden. In the shade.
Well, I don't know about an octopus's garden, but I know that Jim Fizell has helped Chicagoans for decades take care of their gardens here on WGN. On Orion and Max's farm shows, heard for years here on WGN. Today, Jim joins us to answer your questions about all things growing. Jim, the president of James A. Fizell and Associates, is a horticulture consultant and expert, and we are very happy to have him with us here today. Jim, just by judging when you go to the the stores that sell plants, the home and garden centers, tomato plants are everywhere. I'm guessing that's probably the most popular thing for the average person to grow in their yard. Is there anything special that people should do?
It's easy and it's productive, and that's why there's so many people growing them.
And delicious.
You know, they pretty well grow themselves, but you do have to put them in a place where they're going to get as much full sunlight as you can get. You need to be sure that there's some pretty good drainage. Fertilizer needs to be put down before they begin growing, and you don't want to use too much fertilizer. Particularly, I talk about nitrogen a lot because it makes the plants grow, but it doesn't necessarily help them set fruit. And the other thing you need to watch out for, there are some bugs that will come in that will work on them, particularly aphids. Aphids seem to like them, and you need to check your garden. I check my plants at least once a day, looking fairly carefully to find out what's going on. If you begin to see aphids growing on your tomato plant, don't run out and get the sprayer. Snip the little branch off and throw it in the trash, and that will solve your problem.
How would you know that you have aphids? What do they look like?
Well, it's a little tiny normally green insect. They don't move very fast, but they'll begin to cluster on the stem. They'll look kind of a whitish green. If you bother them, they'll wiggle a little bit. They don't really fall off. They occasionally will have wings, but not normally. But they suck the sap out of the shoot tips. They normally get on the shoot tip as it's growing. They may be hidden in the leaves. But if you take a close look, you'll see that that stem looks a little bit peculiar because of the stuff on it. And if that's the case, look and actually, if you squeeze them, they normally, if you pinch them and squash them, they normally have red inside them, so they have a little bit of that. But anyway, it is an insect that will, if you don't control the thing, will actually take the plant over, essentially, because they just reproduce and reproduce. So we're having a little bit of problem with that. The other thing you need to do, if you're watering these plants, be sure that you water the plant, water the soil, not the plant itself. You want them to dry off before nightfall if you can do that. Of course, if we have rain like we've been having lately, you're kind of at the mercy of that. But if you have a chance to allow those plants to dry off before nightfall, you're going to solve a lot of the disease problems. We talked about foliar diseases. They can get tomato plants as well. Other than that, stake them up to keep them off the ground if you can. Use tomato cages. That keeps the plants clean. It keeps the fruit clean. And let them do their thing.
Again, like I was saying before, but with my clematis, I think I've been mispronouncing it all my life. How do you say it? Clematis?
Clematis.
Clematis is the correct way to say it. With my tomato plants, I have several, and all but one of them are doing spectacularly. Same soil, same treatment, same everything.
Yeah. Well, again, it could, if they're all the same varieties, they ought to be growing the same. But I have the same thing in my backyard here, where my tomato plants are. Every once in a while, you'll get one that just doesn't want to get going. Eventually, right. It will.
Yeah, I call it the runt of my litter.
Well, yeah, that could be. Also, you know, there's an advantage to that. If it's slow getting started, it's going to be slow producing. And after all the others are done, maybe it's going to come into its own.
Oh, very
you
nice.
Never know.
Yeah, get some late fruit there. Here's Tony in Racine, Wisconsin, that we were just talking about.
Yes, I am calling from Racine. Come on up sometime. There's lots to show off.
It's a beautiful city. I love Racine. Do you have a question for Jim?
Yes, I do. Jim, thanks for taking my call. And I have shrubs in the front of my house that are kind of overgrown. My thought is to redo some landscaping. I have a tall cedar tree that's higher than the house. And what kind of success with the cedar and the overgrown shrubs might I have if I severely cut them back? Is it possible I might induce some new growth? Or is it better just to get rid of them and start over again? They're over 40 years old.
Well, maybe it's the best thing to get rid of them, but that isn't absolutely necessary. You can prune them, but you don't just chop the daylights out of them. You have to take them down gradually so that you leave green, that's needles or leaves, on the stems each time you cut them back. If you don't leave a stem with green on it, it's not going to grow again. So they can be taken back. In fact, I've seen some people that have taken back some of the big spreading yews that are 20 feet tall and taken them back down to a reasonable size, 3 or 4 feet tall, but it takes maybe a decade to do it. I don't think you want to wait that long.
No, don't want to wait that long, but I just thought maybe if there was a possibility of starting some trimming, you know, that maybe it would induce some new growth.
Right. It will do that. As soon as you open up the canopy on those things and take it back, you'll find that there are buds that are dormant. We'll go ahead and grow, but you still have to have some green at the tip of the leaf. Now, you know, some of us have like challenges. My wife every once in a while says, we need to get rid of that. And I said, well, you know, I'm going to play with it, see if we can't resurrect that thing. And sometimes she wins, sometimes I win. But it can be done, but for those of us who like the challenges in gardening, it's a challenge to take a plant like that and get it back to where it's an attractive asset to the property instead of an overgrown mess.
Yeah, I got to tell you, when I had zero gardening experience prior to owning my first house, and really my intention was just to get things down to a bare minimum, easy maintenance as possible, and I have fallen in love with gardening. It's so relaxing, and Jim, as you're saying, like, you know, experimenting with different things and, you know, getting you do something and getting a result from it, very, very gratifying.
It is. I didn't mean to infer that Jane doesn't like plants. She likes plants, but sometimes she's a little more impatient than I am. But there are other cases where, in fact, she was a houseplant nut before I ever met her, and we don't have many now because we don't stay home enough. But anyway, everybody likes gardening if they can get into it the right way. You know, one of the things that's a big disappointment is for people to start gardening with all good ideas and all good intentions, and then to stop because something adverse happens. And one of the most common things to happen is the garden gets taken over by weeds.
Right.
They are the number one cause of people giving up on gardening.
Wow.
So you need to get onto them as soon as you see them. You pull them out or you hoe them out.
Right.
And get them under control so that your garden can go in and grow. That's another reason for going out essentially daily and walking the rows. And when you walk your rows, take your garden hoe with you. Keep it nice and sharp. And when you see one of those little rascals, cut it out of there and get rid of it before it does any damage to you and gets a head start.
Yeah, before it takes over. Tony, thank you for the call. This is Linda from Arlington Heights. You're on WGN.
Thank you for taking my call. I am struggling with extreme deadwood damage on bushes and shrubs. Specifically, suffered a great deal of damage on the boxwood hedge, which is on the north side of my property. Half of it is, I would say, brown orange, and I also have extreme loss of plant material on the barberries and hibiscus. But my primary question is, what to do on the boxwood? How can we rehabilitate the boxwood on the short term, and what do we do for the long term?
Okay, boxwood is marginally hardy here, but there are different varieties. Some are more hardy than others. Also, it depends on how the plant was growing. If it was good and vigorous and did the proper hardening off for winter time, it probably survived. If it was short on nutrients or not very healthy, it probably did not survive. And by surviving, I mean they do not tolerate the 25 to 28 degree below zero readings that we had this past winter. Very commonly, it will kill the boxwood outright, and it has done that. Now, it may be a selective number of plants within your planting, or it may be just the peripheral of the plants. If it's just the periphery, you can rejuvenate those things. Wait until they've begun to grow from down below, then cut off all the dead wood, cut off all of that stuff that's turned yellow or brown, and let the plant regrow. These plants, if they are of any age whatsoever, they're going to have pretty substantial root systems, and granted, when you lose the top, you're going to lose some of the roots, but the basis is there, so they should regrow pretty nicely. It's the same thing with the barberry and some of these other plants that were killed back by the winter. The other thing you might do, if you know what kind of plant was planted, what the actual variety of that boxwood was, you can check on that and find out if it's one of the hardier varieties. I don't have that right in front of me, and I don't try to keep track of that kind of information, but many of the nurseries do. And if you go around through the neighborhoods looking at boxwood, you're going to find some that's absolutely dead or mostly dead, and you're going to find some that it makes you wonder if there ever was a winter because it's so gorgeous. So there are differences.
Linda, thank you for your call. Jim will come back with more questions on our text line, on our phone line. Somebody asking about organic fertilizers. We'll get to that next. WGN consulting horticulturist, the great Jim Fazell, back with us on WGN to answer your questions. 312-981-7200 to call or text. Jim, Maria on our text line says, I moved my peonies 2 years ago, but they haven't flowered since. Did I do something wrong?
Well, it depends on whether you planted them too deeply or not. If you plant them too deeply, they do not flower very well. That would be my guess. Not an awful lot of other things that might have happened unless the flower buds are being cut off by something in the spring. But if you plant them too deeply, they will eventually grow out of that. But those little roots or that rhizome that you plant needs to be right at the soil surface so that the little pink buds on it are essentially above surface, then they'll go ahead and grow and will make flowers for you. That's the only thing I know of with peonies, because they are so faithful that normally no one has any problem with them. The only problem I've ever had, as I mentioned, is planting them too deeply.
Yeah, or that there are too many of them because they're so prolific.
Right.
The 630 area code is asking, what's your feeling about the use of organic fertilizer versus traditional?
Well, you know, it's a personal choice. Actually, the materials, once they get onto the soil, are very quickly attacked by soil organisms. And it doesn't matter whether it's an inorganic form or an organic form. The organisms down there are going to convert it into a form that they can use, and they do it very quickly. Now, the organic materials contain the nitrogen, which is usually what we're concerned with, the nitrogen in a form that's tied up in proteins that consists of amino acids, which are made up of nitrogen compounds, and the organisms will break that down to get the nitrogen out. That's what they need to live on. When they do that, they break down more than what they actually need, which allows the release of some of that material for other plants to use. They scavenge what the organisms in the soil have left over, and then it becomes the protein in that plant again. With the inorganic materials, like ammonium nitrate or some of those things, they are dissolved into water, with water into a soluble form, which these organisms can take very quickly. They take it in and they grow prolifically on that, making proteins out of it. Of course, then when these organisms that are in the soil have digested whatever they're digesting and they've grown, they eventually die off and they release what they ingested back into organic material, which is picked up by other organisms. So it's a cycle. And okay, where you start the cycle or where you begin with the amount of stuff that you put on really doesn't make a lot of difference to those organisms, but they're personal preferences. The people that want to use something that's so-called natural are right, going to use organic materials that are actually plant-derived one way or another, possibly animal-derived as manures or something like that, and their result is going to be just a little bit delayed, but the same nonetheless.
Okay, good advice, so people can make their own choice with that. Jim, I can't tell you how great it is to hear your voice, to hear your enthusiasm. It's wonderful to talk to you again, and I hope we can do it again very soon. Jim Fazell's president of James A. Fazell and Associates Limited. You do consulting horticulture work still for people all over the country. I'm glad to hear that you're busy and happy, and all of our best to you and your whole family.
Well, thank you, Dean. It's always good to visit with you. I always enjoy it. When we see you out in the neighborhoods, we always like to visit just a little bit, knowing that you're out doing the things that you do as well. And thank you for what you do.
All right, buddy. We'll talk to you soon. There's the great Jim Fazell. We'll wrap things up. Get ready for White Sox pregame coming up next. WGN.